From the home of the Codebreakers and the birthplace of modern computing, this is the Bletchley Park podcast.
Welcome to the July 2026 episode of the Bletchley Park podcast. Focus on Asa Briggs. Lord Asa Briggs, the Keighley born historian of the Victorian age and of broadcasting, served most prominently as Vice-Chancellor of the University of Sussex and later Chancellor of the Open University. He was one of Britain's most influential public intellectuals of the 20th century. Lesser well known, however, is the formative period he spent at Bletchley Park between 1943 and 1945. Arriving somewhat after the time of pioneering code breaking, Asa found a mature Hut 6 working efficiently and at scale. His insights into the work, as well as the social life at Bletchley Park, documented through contemporary diaries and letters, as well as later writing, reveal much about the experiences of the rank-and-file codebreakers in the Bletchley Park Intelligence Factory. Bletchley Park's research officer, Dr. Thomas Cheetham, is joined by Adam Sisman, author of The Indefatigable Asa Briggs, to focus on the life of this era-defining figure. This episode is interspersed with an interview we recorded with Lord Briggs on one of his last visits to Bletchley Park.
Adam, welcome to the podcast.
I'm very pleased to be here.
Firstly, could we just start off by asking you, for those who aren't familiar with him, who was Asa Briggs?
Asa Briggs was basically an academic. He was born in Yorkshire in the town of Keighley, near the Yorkshire Moors in 1921. He was outstandingly clever, so much so that although he enrolled, got a place at Cambridge to read history and emerged 3 years later with a first, he also had, unknown to his tutors, enrolled at the LSE to read economics and got a first in that simultaneously. And after his studies, he was called up into the army and after a hiatus, found his way to Bletchley Park. Later on, after he was at Bletchley, he became a well-known historian and academic and a founding father of Sussex University and of the Open University as well.
In many ways, you know, the start of his career comes out of Bletchley Park and it's a formative period in his life. And that's obviously what we're going to focus on today.
Yes. Interestingly, he referred to Bletchley as my second university. And he learnt things there that perhaps he hadn't learnt at Cambridge or the LSE.
So he'd been at Cambridge just before the war, in the early part of the war. Is that correct?
Exactly. Yeah. And in fact, his admissions tutor, he was only 16 when he went up to Cambridge for an interview, said, "You're just a baby, Briggs, but I'm going to admit you because there's a war coming and it's best that you get your studies done before you wear in uniform."
But what I find really interesting is that interview was James Passant, wasn't it?
It was.
And he ends up working at Bletchley on commercial code breaking.
Yes.
And he's one of a number of names that we hear about in the biography of people who go off and do code-breaking during the war.
I think Briggs's college, Sydney Sussex, was overrepresented at Bletchley. Quite a number of Sydney Sussex alumni played prominent or less prominent roles there. In fact, the way in which Briggs got to Bletchley, there's some doubt about, but it seems to have been that a fellow undergraduate had preceded him there, with whom he used to play bridge, a chap called Howard Smith, who later on became a diplomat and served with MI5, and I think became head of MI5, did he not?
I believe he did, yeah.
Yeah. Anyway, Howard Smith, with whom Briggs endlessly played bridge in 1939-1940, had got to Bletchley, and he seems to have said, I think, had recommended Briggs as another recruit.
But his route in is actually a little bit more convoluted than that, isn't it? Because even though he's in that group of people, it's not a simple matter of just plucking him from the university.
That's right. Originally, he had been interviewed by C.P. Snow, who was an academic at Cambridge, later best known, of course, as a novelist, but he in fact was a chemist, I think. And Snow had some kind of role, I think called Director of Scientific Personnel, in recruiting clever people for the war effort. And Snow originally seems to have earmarked young Asa Briggs for work in radar, but that didn't come off for one reason or another. And Briggs found his way, first of all, in the Royal Corps of Signals, and then later in the Intelligence Corps, and quite quickly into Bletchley.
But I will talk a bit more about that Royal Corps of Signals work as well, because he was actually trained as an intercept operator, was he not?
Yes, he was, which gave him some practical know-how, which was arguably useful in his code breaking, because, you know, what they were doing was trying to work out what people like Briggs had been were encrypting on their Enigma machines. So he had some idea of what the person at the other end, the person who had originated the message, the signal, was actually doing, and what it felt like to be doing that.
You know, that a bit of knowledge of how Morse code works and how radio works is something that a lot of people talk about picking up in Hut 6, but Acer actually came in with some of that knowledge already, which must have been very helpful.
Yes, exactly.
And then he goes off, he's trained in kind of field security work, isn't he? But that doesn't go too well.
He is trained in field security work. He is not really an ideal recruit, certainly for riding motorbikes. He spends, I think, a whole day trying to learn to ride a motorbike and crashes it. And in fact, he never learned to drive throughout his whole life. So that was a bit of a fiasco. He wasn't a very practical person or an athletic person, but he was a very clever person. Briggs's view, I mean, you may correct me, you may have a different view, but the key thing he thought for a codebreaker was imagination, trying to imagine what the signal might be and what might be being said, and then to work out a crypt.
What do you know about Acer's experiences when he arrived in Hut 6 in the middle of 1943?
Well, he was struck by various things. One of the things he was struck by was the number of telephones. He said he'd never seen so many telephones in his life. He'd never made a telephone call before the outbreak of war. His family didn't have a telephone at home. It's quite hard to imagine that now. And he was sent into a bit of a panic when these telephones started ringing. Another thing he noticed straight away, of course, was the number of women there. I think I'm right in saying he certainly quotes a figure that there were almost three times as many women as there were men. Young women, clever women, attractive women. He was, of course, a young man himself. It was a very enticing environment for a young man fresh out of university. And indeed, he had a number of girlfriends there, one of whom he nearly married.
I think it's a really good reminder that we often see Bletchley Park as, you know, it's a very young organisation, but we often see it through this lens of people who are much later in life. And looking at Acer's letters and his diaries that I've had a look at as well as you, you get a reminder of how young everybody was.
Yes.
And how they act like young people. And that is one of the main ways I think it is like a university in that comparison that he draws.
Well, some of them are straight out of school, aren't they? There are an awful lot of the people working at Bletchley who are in their 20s. And not many who are much older. So it is just like a university. And as I say, he used that analogy, my second university. He took various lessons which he felt that Bletchley taught him, which he used later in his academic career, particularly as a career as an academic pioneer and administrator.
And what lessons were those?
Well, one was the value of teamwork. I mean, he concluded, and I think it was unarguable, that people working together in a common effort could achieve far more than those same people working separately. Another was of what he called interdisciplinary, I can't pronounce it, larity, of people working across traditional boundaries between disciplines. He disliked those, and in his career, particularly setting up at Sussex, wanted to break down the barriers, for example, between history and the social sciences and indeed between science and the humanities, but more specifically between different branches of the sciences and different branches of the humanities. He wanted geographers to be able to talk to social scientists, to be able to talk to economists, historians, indeed people studying languages. He thought there was a lot to be gained from that. And he was frustrated in some of the old universities that the disciplines were so ring-fenced. And at Sussex, he saw an opportunity to dismantle those fences, to take them down and to allow people to go wherever their interest took them. I mean, at Bletchley, I don't need to tell you, there were people from all kinds of backgrounds, both academic backgrounds, but also backgrounds that just gave them an aptitude for that kind of work. They might be chess champions or crossword aficionados, or they weren't necessarily mathematicians. There were classicists, there were historians, people of many different kinds, including several poets, I think.
And he was a poetry writer himself, wasn't he, Acer? But then so many at Bletchley were.
Yes, not very good, but yes, perhaps everyone was writing poetry when they were 22 or 23, I don't know.
I'm delighted to be back in the house, Bletchley Park, which I've known for a very long time indeed, and the history of which I've studied before there's anybody from Bletchley here at all, the story of the Montefiore family. It's an eccentric house, and my memory of Bletchley as the years go by tends to concentrate myself on eccentrics who were here. And one of the biggest of them was Josh Cooper, who moved on to GCHQ. In my new book, which has just come out, which is called Loose Ends and Extras, I chose Loose Ends because it came from a very popular radio programme, Ned Sherrin's. And I knew Ned Sherrin well, and I felt that I wanted to do justice to his memory. In the book, I have got chapters on the First World War, which I still call the Great War. I think it's very different from the Second World War. And I found that writing that chapter was immensely interesting. And my son very kindly drove me over to the Somme under the tunnel, which I'd never been under before. And when I got to the other side, I recognised at once all kinds of places which I had seen when I was a boy. Because I first went there in 1934, which is an immensely long time ago now. And I stayed in a house by the sea at a place which nobody knows called Ult, which was on the Channel coast. And I looked back at the holidays as I'd spent there with the family with whom I stayed. And I'm all in favour of real family visits and not just getting involved in a school party, going on a trip.
A proper exchange.
Yes. I found Ult most interesting, and I'm very glad that my son took me there. And we had the best oysters as I'd had for a long time, and I love oysters.
I think it's really fascinating to think about how Acer came in at this point where things were pretty well laid down. So he wasn't one of these pioneer codebreakers who has to build the system from the ground up, like Gordon Welshman, obviously, most prominently, also from Sydney, Sussex. So he comes in and he sees these systems in place, but you can only imagine someone of his nous would have looked at the system he was in the middle of and kind of unpicked it in his head and been thinking about how all these pieces are fitting together and how they must have been put together in the years before he arrived. And the idea that he learnt lessons from that, which stayed with him for the rest of his career, is a really fascinating one.
Yes. I think he, like a lot of the codebreakers, shared a frustration with obstructive bureaucracy. One of the things he emphasises in his book, he wrote a book specifically about his time at Bletchley, Secret Days, is that rank was much less important than people think. He himself actually never achieved a commissioned rank. He says, and I'd see no reason to doubt this, that his work was too important for him to be able to spare the time for officer training. He was promoted as a non-commissioned officer and eventually became, apparently, the most senior warrant officer rank available. He became a regimental sergeant major. And there's a story, an amusing story, of his going to be interviewed late in the war for a position at Worcester College at Oxford. And the fellows of Worcester, hearing that they're about to interview a regimental sergeant major, imagine they're going to be meeting a large man with a handlebar moustache and a loud voice. So they're rather surprised when actually a rather small, unassuming figure waddles through into the room.
Very much unmilitary.
Definitely unmilitary. Incorrigibly so.
You know, this is, again, quite common. I think being a regimental sergeant major is slightly exceptional, but people being promoted to get them the pay they deserve, despite them really being essentially civilians, pretty typical for Bletchley.
He was under pressure from his family, who couldn't understand why he hadn't got a commission. I mean, they didn't know anything of his work or where he worked or what he was doing, but they just thought, you know, why isn't our brilliant son an officer like, you know, X or Y? And of course, he couldn't really explain to them why this was so.
You get a sense, don't you, of what's weighing on his mind. And a lot is weighing on his mind. You have the promotion issue, the embarrassment of that with his family.
Yes.
You have relationships as well. I wondered if you could tell us a bit more about how all that unfolds.
Yeah, I mean, there is pressure from his family, as you say, and he feels also a certain awkwardness that he is of a lower rank than other people doing the same thing. He becomes very friendly with Roy Jenkins, for example, the future Labour politician who has arrived as a captain. And in fact, in the letter of introduction, the person who introduces them says, differences of rank may make it difficult for you to socialise, but Ace is very keen to say that's not the case. But anyway, there's a constant pressure. Yeah, his diaries are full of accounts of involvement with, for example, with girlfriends, and I really like so-and-so, but I'm not sure if she, you know, and that sort of thing. And I'm serious about this. The most serious of the girlfriends, the one he nearly married, came from a Catholic family. She was Scottish, from Glasgow, and they wanted him to convert, and he just wasn't prepared to do that. So that was the breaking point. I've seen a photograph of her. She was a very, very pretty woman, so I can see why he was attracted to her. Lily O'Hara, I think her name was.
Possibly one of these recruits from to do with Aberdeen University that we hear of, because there was meant to be a whole cohort of young women from the Scottish universities who come in through the auspices of Stuart Milner Barry and his connections with the women's colleges.
There's also a lot about daily life, about visiting the Americans at their camp at Little Brickhill, and the, to him, exotic food that are available there, and just the fun, and, you know, simple things like playing table tennis.
There's a paragraph I thought I might read out from his book, actually, on this subject, because I thought it just sums it up really nicely. He's talking about Frank Stanton, who is actually in the photo, which is the image for this episode. And we have Frank's photo album, including several photos of Asa. He writes in 2011, "Through my relationship with Frank, I eventually learned as much about American music as I learned about American food and drink at the camp. At Little Brick Hill, I ate my first avocados, tasted my first American coffee, infinitely superior to the coffee we drank in Hut 6 or at Shenley Road, and drank my first bourbon and my first dry martini. I was never the same again." You wonder if there's an indication there. I mean, Asa was a bit of an epicure, wasn't he? Quite a lot of an epicure.
He was a bit of an epicure, and both Asa and his wife drank in really quite remarkable amounts. It was quite hard to keep up with them in later life. But of course, he hadn't started like that. I mean, when he went on a foreign exchange as a schoolboy to a French family, he was presented with an artichoke, and he didn't know what to do with it. So to the bemusement of his host, he ate the whole thing. That, again, it's an interesting reminder of how different life was pre-war, certainly in a working-class family in the provinces.
Do you think it was something quite common to that wartime generation to, you know, enjoy food and drink and the finer things in life after going through rationing and experiencing wartime Britain?
I think there is a sort of perhaps an untold story of how much the good things of life appealed after all the austerity and all the hardship. Certainly, I wrote a book about Hugh Trevor Roper, and he was very keen, he and his associates in Oxford, to live well, to drink good wine, to eat good food, to try and get away from the grimness and the greyness that they had endured through the war years.
Can we talk a bit more about the work and about how Asa experienced that? What exactly is he doing in Hut 6, and how does he describe his experiences?
Well, you're probably better qualified to describe this to me, but I mean, he's on the watch, which means they have this 8-hour running system for signals coming in. And as soon as a signal comes in from the Y service receiving stations, they try and decrypt it as quickly as possible. But there are long periods when they're doing nothing, when nothing's happening, and then brief periods of intense activity. In those long periods of doing nothing, of course, there's plenty of opportunity for discussions about politics and other things, and flirtation, indeed, and just general jollities. But then, as I say, there's the moments of intense activities which might occur in the middle of the night or any hour, really. So in terms of his specific responsibilities, Asa was particularly concerned. There was allotted the so-called Puma key, which I think is a Luftwaffe key, and took a particular interest in what was going on in the Balkans, and particularly in Yugoslavia. And at the time when Asa joined Hut 6, Yugoslavia, there were partisan movements, two main groups of partisans holding down remarkable numbers of German troops, and the British were keen to decide who to support. One was a communist-led group, which eventually became the basis of the post-war government under Tito, and the other was a more right-wing and royalist group, the Chetniks. And the conclusion was reached, and Asa felt this quite strongly, that the communist partisans were doing far more to distract the Germans and occupy the Germans than the Chetniks. And that may have fed through into his work, I don't know. But that's certainly what, in the end, SOE decided to do, to support the communist partisans.
But he was getting an insight through his work in, you know, the international situation, what was going on in the war effort, and he was benefiting from that, wasn't he?
Certainly he was. I mean, that's a very curious thing, I think, about Bletchley, is that people who might be of quite junior rank got a picture of what was happening on a much larger scale, of a type that information that just wasn't available to people in the field. I mean, I remember talking to my father, who was a naval officer, and he said, you know, most of the time we didn't really know what was going on. You know, we were just ordered to do this, ordered to do that. Even in command of a ship, you know, you were ordered to patrol this area or that area or join that convoy, but you didn't know what the wider significance of it was. Whereas in Bletchley, they got some sense of that. And indeed, they intercepted very important signals. I mean, ASA intercepted the signal of the German surrender. After Hitler's suicide, the Dönitz government sent a message in clear, I think, announcing that all troops should cease fighting. He happened to be on the watch when this signal came through, and obviously a momentous signal.
I was interested to read in the biography about this other project that ASA's working on while he's at Bletchley, which is this publication on peacemaking. Can you tell us anything about that?
Yes, it was something set up with David Thompson, who was a young tutor at Sydney Sussex. And there was a third author whose name temporarily escapes me, who was a Middle European living in England, in exile in England. It's called Patterns of Peacemaking. And the idea was to study efforts to make peace and what happens and what's successful and what isn't successful. And this was very much on people's minds because, of course, there was a general view that Versailles had, in fact, not worked and had led to the Second World War, and that people were very anxious to avoid that happening again at the end of another ghastly global conflict. So it was an extremely topical subject, even though the book itself is quite stodgy and not obviously addressed to a wider public.
We've talked a little bit about this idea of, you know, creativity in the work. You know, how ASA is emblematic of historians as codebreakers as opposed to mathematicians.
I fall down here on not really being very good on the technical side of how the machines works, but as I understand it, you know, what was very important in establishing CRIB was to try and imagine what the signal might actually say, what the words might be, and therefore to try and put yourself in the mind of both the person actually sending the message, but also the person who had drafted the message, and look for key words, for example, which might be in the signal. Once you've got a word, you've got the beginning of a crib. So ASA argued, you can argue against this or not, but historians are used to doing this. I mean, one of the things that historians do is they look at documents from the past and they need to understand the significance of the document. Who has written the document? Why are they writing it? What is the significance of it? How will it be read? How will it be understood? Is there a subtext? What is its significance? What can we say about what was happening at that time from this document? And so this is, as it were, the same process, but backwards. And so I think it is a reasonable argument that historians are well qualified for that kind of work.
Where is ASA living while he's at Bletchley?
Well, before he's posted to Bletchley, he's doing an Intelligence Corps cryptography course in Bedford and meets some quite remarkable people, not necessarily very military people. I mean, the people who went into the Intelligence Corps were of a certain kind and not conventional soldiers by any means. And so he makes friends there that people who will crop up later in his life. As a curious thing, actually, ASA, as a boy, invented his own language, which he called Aeotix, and then invented a code for that language. I don't think the authorities at Bletchley knew this when he was posted there, but it could arguably have given him a bit of useful background. He obviously had an aptitude for that sort of thing. Like a lot of clever children, he lived a lot in his imagination as a boy and created his own kind of worlds, including his own, you know, for a brief period, had his own newspaper, which he published.
And he was multilingual as well, wasn't he?
He was multilingual, yes. He had become particularly fluent in French because of these exchange courses that he'd done. He'd done, I think, three as a schoolboy. And there were reciprocal visits by his French schoolboy friends to his house in Keighley. What they made of Keighley, I find quite difficult to imagine, but there we are. He was introduced, by the way, to fine dining as a schoolboy, something completely outside his experience. I mean, his father was a grocer until the shop went bankrupt in the early 1930s. So they had plenty of food, but it was fairly conventional, unrelenting diet, and certainly nothing like olive oil or garlic.
Keighley not really a centre of fine dining at that point in time.
Yes. After he's been in these digs in Bedford, he moves into a camp. I'm trying to remember the name of the camp.
The Shanley Road camp, just next to Bletchley Park. So you have obviously an army camp and an Air Force camp right next door to each other, just outside the gates.
And the curious thing is that the chap who is running the camp, who is a soldier, isn't privileged to know what's going on in Bletchley Park and is perpetually frustrated by this and irritated by it. And there are his subordinates trotting through the gates of Bletchley to do this mysterious work. And the camp commandant has no idea what's going on there. There's a lot in Ace's diaries, too, about fun things, you know, putting on plays or going to concerts. As I mentioned, table tennis, lots of sort of bicycle rides, visits to the pub. There's an awful lot of that sort of thing going on.
It's something really that maybe references the recent podcast we did on music at Bletchley Park. So we were talking in that episode about Herbert Morrill, who was a friend of Ace's, wasn't he, in the camp?
Yes.
And a lot has been said about the Bletchley Park Recreational Society and about off-duty activities inside the wire, but there was also a lot going on in the camps. They were kind of social networks and social scenes of their own, distinct from Bletchley Park itself.
Yes, and I think they had a lot of fun. Quite high quality of music, I think, of concerts too. I suppose really, you know, there are all these young people, young men and women, and they need to be kept entertained and focused.
Absolutely.
And unlike regular troops who may be stationed in some remote place, they are going in and out of BP so that they have to fill their leisure time. And they're full of energy and full of interest in lots of different things. That's another thing that Asa talks about at Bletchley is meeting lots of different sorts of people and learning from them, specialists in other fields, people who just had extraordinary skills, people, as I mentioned before, poets, just interesting people of many different kinds. And so it must have been a very stimulating environment to be in. Again, much more fun, perhaps, than a conventional army unit.
Someone like Asa who just soaks all that up, doesn't he?
Yes, exactly.
I haven't really changed my tastes or my views all that much since I was at Bletchley. I learnt a lot from Bletchley, and it taught me about bringing people from diverse backgrounds and diverse subjects together. And I think it's a pity to concentrate too much on the mathematicians. I think the historians played an absolutely basic part here because it was part of my job as a historian to be able to get inside the mind of the person who sent a message. And that is a very necessary help to cryptography. I think we were very good crib breakers through the way in which we interested ourselves in the people who were sending the messages. And I got deeply interested in messages coming from the Balkans. And I found that those messages taught me a great deal about Tito and his opponents. And they introduced me to Bill Deakin, who was a very remarkable man and a good friend of mine, with whom I remained in touch for the rest of my life. And Deakin got me involved in writing for Winston Churchill's History of the English People. And I was not allowed to publish anything about that, but I've discovered some of the bits which I kept. And when I got a cheque from Churchill for writing these comments and a letter of thanks, I hesitated for a very long time about whether to cash the cheque. I needed the money, so I cashed it.
Wasn't it Tommy Cooper or someone used to sign checks to people knowing that people yes. would never cash them because yes. they've basically got his autograph?
I feel myself that I should have kept it, but I was offered more in that check than I was paid in a year by my college.
It's nice that you equate the eccentricities of the house to the people yes. as well, I think. I think that's one of the things that I always see. I think of this really strange-looking house with all its different
yes.
styles of architecture, and it's like you say, it's different disciplines. It was the linguists, it was the historians, yes. the mathematicians. It was that mix of people that really made this place work, wasn't it?
They did, and in this very building, there were people who came across and did the Times crossword puzzle in their lunch break, and I thought they were unbelievable.
Can you tell us about what Asa got up to just after the war as he left Bletchley Park?
In fact, Asa had a job lined up as a fellow of Worcester. By a strange series of accidental causes, he was taken up by one of the senior tutors he got to know and taken up at Worcester, and then courted to apply for a fellowship there, and went, as I said earlier, to meet the fellows as a regimental sergeant major. And so he had the offer of a job there already and was able to get an early discharge. As you know, quite a lot of people at the end of the war were kept hanging around for months and months and months, but he was able to start at the beginning of the Michaelmas, which is the autumn term, at Oxford in 1945. At the end of the war, there's a bit of winding up. It's slightly complicated, and there's an incident where he has to take a unit of troops to London for some kind of training course. Asa has to march them down the Marylebone Road, and the thought of Asa Briggs apparently was pretty disorganized and a bit shaming. The thought of this incident is quite amusing. When that's all over, he gets his discharge papers. There's an emotional scene with the commandant of the camp who advises him to beware of women.
This is the same commandant who'd been at Bletchley, Colonel Fillingham.
Colonel Fillingham, exactly. And then he goes off and he goes to some kind of centre where he...
He's demobbed, yes.
I think it's somewhere near Aylesbury that he goes. Anyway, he goes, he sort of changes out of his uniform, changes into this suit. I think he's given two suits, actually.
Doesn't he also get a hat that he doesn't wear? Yes.
A hat that he never wore, apparently. Yes. And he's a civilian. And off he goes to Oxford.
So a fairly smooth transition to civilian life for Asa, if not for everybody else.
A very smooth transition to civilian life. And it's quite curious because he arrives there at this very small college. There are only about a dozen fellows, most of whom are much older than him, one of whom has been there, I think, since the late 19th century. And he's somewhat appalled by their lack of interest in the great global conflict that's been going on, but he has to keep his mouth shut a lot of the time. He quickly makes himself a useful member of the college. And then the old provost of Worcester eventually is persuaded to retire in his mid-80s, and a new provost is elected. And this is J.C. Masterman, who had been involved in intelligence work in the war, and as I think he was chairman of the Double Cross Committee. And so this is in many ways a relief for Asa, because with Masterman, when they're in private together, they're able to talk about things that he's not able to talk to anyone else about. And actually, Masterman's secretary had also been at Bletchley Park, so that's another kind of contact for him. He goes to Worcester, and he stays there almost 10 years, and then he's offered a chair, very early age again. I mean, he's in his mid-30s at Leeds, and he goes to Leeds, which is very close to where he comes from, like going back home. And he stays at Leeds a few years, but he's very increasingly frustrated at Leeds by what he calls departmentalism and the fact that he can't get, for example, E.P. Thompson, who is a lecturer in extramural studies, is not allowed to lecture to his undergraduates or indeed his postgraduates. There's a separate department of economic history, and the economic historians are very jealous of their separation from the conventional historians. And this is not the way Asa thinks at all. So when he's offered a chance to get in on the ground floor with a new university, Sussex, you know, there's nothing exists. He's the very first recruit by the founding vice-chancellor. He jumps at it, and he goes to Sussex at a time when there are no students, no buildings, nothing. They temporarily rent a couple of Victorian houses in Hove, and only 2 years later move on to the new campus. And at Sussex, he's really formative in creating a new kind of university where these barriers between disciplines and some of the lessons that he's learned at Bletchley Park are put into practice. And he sees this not as just as a conventional university, but as a new kind of academic institution which can draw in the whole community, which offers facilities for people in middle age or indeed older people, for people who are not conventional undergraduates, for people who missed out on traditional qualifications. In other words, a sort of learning centre, a hub for people throughout the local community. And an example of how a university could be not just for the rest of Britain, but for the whole world. And people do come and look at it from all over the world. And it's very exciting and very fashionable. I mean, Sussex is portrayed in such unlikely magazines as Vogue, Tatler and Reader's Digest. And it is described by some as Balliol by the Sea. Anyway, in due course, Fulton retires. Briggs becomes vice chancellor himself and was vice chancellor when I went there as an undergraduate in the early 1970s. I'm going back there, in fact, on Tuesday to receive an honorary degree, I'm pleased to say.
Oh, well, congratulations.
Yeah, thank you. It's rather nice. And I've had to try and remember my time at Sussex, think how different things were then. Very, very different. And Ace is there as vice chancellor for something like 10 years. And then he accepts an offer to go back to Worcester as provost. The existing provost is retiring and they offer him this job. Some people think this is a retreat. Some people think he's given up his reforming instincts. And there are two views as to that move. Other people feel he's done what he can do and he needs to move on and do something different. In the meantime, the Open University has been set up. He's been on the planning committee and he eventually becomes not the first, but the third chancellor of the Open University, which is, as you know, a more honorific role. But as chancellor, he hands out degrees to Open University's graduates. So that's in brief his career. He retires eventually in his early 70s from Worcester. And all the time he's busy writing books. It's hard to say exactly how many books, because some of them, it's arguable whether they're separate volumes, but there are at least 50, and some of them very substantial volumes indeed, including the mammoth five-volume history of broadcasting, more than 4,000 pages of it, which is either a masterwork or a white elephant, depending on your point of view. He's a very prominent figure in his time in the media. He's a very well-known and indeed is offered a peerage by Jim Callaghan just as he's retiring from Sussex and so becomes Lord Briggs of Lewis.
And how does Asa kind of react when Bletchley Park becomes public knowledge? Is he in the camp of, you know, those who are happy to see it come out, or...?
I think he's actually the opposite. I think he's quite cautious okay. about it. But apart from talking to those people he knows he is allowed to talk to, he, like so many of them, is very good about keeping his mouth shut. And so, I mean, he never told his wife until the ultra secret came out. He would occasionally say to her, apparently, something like, oh, that's someone I knew in the war, or that's one of the Hut 6 mob, but she didn't know what Hut 6 meant, and over the years that passed. And so it wasn't until the 1980s that he was able to tell her what he'd been doing. I mean, he has talked to Ralph Bennett and Ronald Lewin, to historians, and I think Ronald Lewin writes about Ultra in the field and how Ultra intelligence was passed through the special liaison units and used by military commanders, particularly, I think, in the Western Desert. But in general, he's one of those who's reluctant to talk. And then he feels, after Winterbottom's book, and people start to talk more freely about Bletchley, he feels that an awful lot of the accounts are self-serving. And his perspective is that his own contribution is a corrective to that, which, you know, one can make up one's own mind about. It's a curious book, really, and it's a bit of a hybrid.
We do know he was involved with reunions with other members of Hut 6, especially one in 1981 we've got some evidence of.
Yes, he goes to reunions, and there was an episode of Radio 4's The Reunion around Bletchley Park that he took part in, presented by Sue McGregor, I think. That's quite a lot later. He even takes part in a MasterChef episode that's filmed at Bletchley Park. I mean, the sense that you get from his memoir, Secret Days, is that it's important to get the details right, and that's why he's writing the book, and to get the feel right.
So he writes that in 2011. Do you think that is a big motivation for him to lay it all out and get it correct while he's there to write about it, why others are still around to give their impressions as well?
Yes. And of course, by then, they're disappearing at a rapid rate. I mean, he's only got 5 years left to live himself. As we know, the past is always slipping away from us.
But it's the impression I got definitely from another look at Secret Days ahead of this recording, is that it's very wide-ranging, and Asa does bring in, you know, a lot of experiences that weren't his own. It's not a narrow personal memoir. He does try and give a good history of Bletchley Park.
Well, as I say, it is a bit of a hybrid book, and, I mean, there is a personal memoir in it, including some information that isn't directly relevant to Bletchley about his journey, as it were. But as you say, yes, there is then some stuff which isn't really personal at all. And so, yeah, I would call it a hybrid.
I arrived just after Block D was completed, And there I had a very interesting 2 years because we were there for D-Day and I was very much an admirer of the man who ran the watch in Utsick, John Manistee, who had been at Marlborough, which was a school which sent a lot of people here. And after the end of the war, he became a housemaster at Winchester. So I used to go and stay with him in Winchester. And of course, he's one of the few people I could talk to about intelligence. My wife knew nothing about. People would occasionally say to me, what was it like in Utsick? Or do you ever go back to Utsick? And she'd say, what is Utsick? And I couldn't really properly tell her. I wasn't really bound by secrecy because of the signed the Official Secrets Act. I believed myself that it was very important not to give away what we'd been doing because it was important to winning the war. And I was a bit uneasy when people began to write about the secrets of Bletchley, to tell the truth, even long after the event. By that time, I had actually told my wife that I'd been breaking codes at Bletchley. And also, we went to Woburn Abbey several times. And I met people there I'd known when political intelligence was in Woburn Abbey. I knew rather more of that during the war than most people who were working at Bletchley.
How did you feel when Winterbottom's book came out?
Well, I thought it was a good thing that it came out, but I think it was a very bad book and full of mistakes.
Yes, obviously, there's a Coventry myth that's grown from that book, hasn't it?
And also, he didn't understand the bomb. He didn't really understand anything, to my mind, about the way that Bletchley really worked. I did know Ronald Lewin very well, and I did feel that by the time he was writing, I could really talk to him about Bletchley. And I knew him very well through the BBC. I never expected, of course, I should say, when I was here, that there would be an open university in Milton Keynes.
Well, when you were here, it was a tiny village, wasn't it?
It was a tiny village. I did know Newport Pagnell very well, and various bits and pieces of what has become Milton Keynes complex. But I find that when I go round the district now, places come to my mind. And I do remember we didn't have to do much military work when I was at Bletchley, but I do remember very clearly on one or two marches seeing all the blackthorn out in all its beauty, and I'd never seen any blackthorn in the north of England where I was born. So that even the landscape around Bletchley, with about enormous numbers of brick chimneys, really was a change for me.
Thank you so much.
Well, glad to do
it. Some lovely memories there as
yes.
well. Thank you very much, sir.
Well, good to
thank you for your service.
Can you tell us about how you came to write your biography of Asa?
Yes, I had written two previous biographies of historians, A.J.P. Taylor and Hugh Trevor Roper. I don't know of anybody else actually who's written two, let alone three biographies of historians. And I found subsequently that Asa mentions this in one of his memoirs, because I was an undergraduate at Sussex University when he was vice-chancellor there, and he mentions my name, rather to my surprise, as the author of two well-regarded biographies. Well, one of the odd experiences about getting older is you do come across yourself from time to time in archives, and I had an example of this when I was working on the Asa Briggs biography, which was finding a diary entry of his where he's discussing in the diary whether someone might write his biography. And he says in this entry, words to this effect, if someone is to do it, I imagine it will be Sisman. And of course, that was quite a moment when I came across that. So I was approached by another historian who said that the family, the Briggs family, after Asa's death, were looking for someone to write his biography. I got in touch with Asa's widow, Susan, and went to stay a weekend at the house in Lewes, and I was able to see the archive in the cellar there, which I must say was a very daunting experience, and it's very much unsorted and in a muddle and enormous. There's a cellar full of shelving with box after box after box.
And that's reflected in your book. I mean, very little of it really is about Bletchley. That's what we're focusing on today, but there's so much more there.
Oh, yes. I mean, he was a very wide-ranging individual, and You know, one of the interesting things about him is that he's part of that group of left-leaning post-war. He could easily have been a member of the 1964 Wilson government. And in fact, most of the members of the cabinet were his contemporaries and personal friends. Even the Prime Minister himself, when he writes to Wilson, he writes, "Dear Harold." But people like Roy Jenkins, Tony Crossland, Richard Crossman, they're all personal friends of his.
And he did narrowly avoid entering politics in 1945. Isn't that right?
Yes, he was on the list. There was a sort of list for constituency Labour parties to select. And several did ask him if he would stand, including at least one eminently winnable seat. He decided in the end not to stand, and in fact campaigned for Roy Jenkins in a then rather difficult Conservative-leaning seat in Birmingham. But he was drawn to the Labour Party. Anyway, he's part of that post-war consensus of people who were not necessarily highly political, but wanted to get things to make a better Britain, a fairer Britain, a Britain which both worked better and was more egalitarian. And in particular, from his point of view, it gave educational opportunities to those who otherwise had missed out. He felt and believed very passionately that there was enormous waste of talent of people who, for one reason or another, didn't benefit from educational opportunities. And so his work, both in universities, but also more widely, was always done with that in view. It's actually rather interesting that he comes from a very similar background to somebody who reached a very different view of how British society should be shaped, and that's Margaret Thatcher. They both come from similar-sized provincial towns, not very fashionable. They're both the children of someone who runs a grocer's shop, and there's a strong element of nonconformism in both. In Briggs's case, his mother was a Congregationalist. He, in fact, preached as a schoolboy in Congregationalist and Baptist chapels. But they came to very different conclusions about how society should be shaped, and arguably Mrs. Thatcher undermined a lot of the things that Asa had been trying to build up, but not the Open University, which was arguably one of his great causes.
This is what brought it back to Milton Keynes in the end.
Yes, brought it back to Milton Keynes. He suggests that this might not have been a coincidence, though I think that's a rather ridiculous thing to say myself. But yes, I mean, he's not the only one, of course, and he's not the prime mover behind the Open University, but he's one of the prime movers, and he's on the planning committee. He's one of those who's also behind Wilson's original idea that he puts forward in the 1963 Labour Party conference. So I was just talking about how I came to write the book. I went to go and spend a weekend with Susan Briggs, Lady Briggs, and had a look at the archive. And I was quite startled, in fact, to receive a message on my return on the Monday morning from my agent saying that HarperCollins wanted to commission my biography of Asa Briggs. Things moved very fast. 3 years later, the hardback volume of the book was published. The paperback volume is just due to come out in a couple of weeks' time.
Fantastic. And it's a great read, and it's very thorough. And the period of Bletchley Park makes up only a very small part of the biography, really. And Asa obviously had a long and very active and energetic life. So, Adam, how do you see Bletchley Park in his entire life and career? What sort of influence is it on him?
Well, I think it's a key influence on him. I mean, it's significant in itself. He played a small part in history, but it's significant in the forming of the person that he became, and in particular his ideas about how people can work together and about the artificiality of boundaries between different disciplines. And these are lessons that took him right through at Sussex and at the Open University, that these are strongly held beliefs that were formed as a result of the experience of Bletchley Park.
Thanks to the paid and volunteer staff, visitors and veterans who took part in this podcast. To find out more, go to bletchleypark.org.uk. You can follow Bletchley Park on Twitter, Facebook and Instagram. This podcast is produced for the Bletchley Park Trust by MC Fontaine and supported by Audioboom. If you like this podcast, please leave us a review on iTunes. Thanks for listening, and we'll have more decrypts from the home of the Codebreakers next month.